Hello, welcome to our latest Rest is History bonus podcast for you, the club members, the friends of the show. As always, we are thrilled, excited by your patronage, aren't we, Tom?
We are.
We owe you a slight apology because I think last week we put out a podcast that had, shockingly, Tom, because we are no fans of the free market or of promotional
activities. We disapprove of that. We disapprove of that very, very strongly.
Shockingly, a podcast went out to you, the members, with adverts. I won't say the beer company, Beer 52, that...
Dominic, that, I mean, yeah. we are, in principle, very, very much opposed to that kind of thing, aren't we? And we were bullied into it by the producers.
Bullied is the word, actually. There was a
bullied.
Lot of, yeah, it was awful.
So we would like to apologise on behalf of the producers who have accepted full responsibility for that. We hope it will never happen again.
Definitely not. If it happens again, I would be gutted. If their producers contacted me and said, another company wanted, I would be
destroyed. And give you money, we would just say no.
We would. Right. So we have just released, so I don't know when you'll be getting this, but we have just released our first... So the Genghis Khan podcasts, which I think you, the members will have got both of them at once, but the public have just got number one. Tom, that was fun, wasn't it? Genghis Khan, our friend Ali Ansari.
You mean Genghis Khan?
Yes, of course. Well, thank God you didn't say it in your John Wayne voice. That would be very disturbing.
Well, thank goodness you didn't say it in your faintly Arabic-sounding villain voice.
No, Tom, that's actually how... Because don't forget, Mongols, I mean, because of the Mongol expansion, the Mongol intonation has actually seeped into a lot of other accents, which is why my Mongol voice, I think, was very, very acutely judged.
right. In the way that my Liam Neeson accent was.
Of course, exactly so. Yeah, exactly right. So we've got lots to get through because we've been on delving into the Discord, or rather, really, Sam has been delving onto the Discord to tease out the most interesting things. So let's just kick off. There was some discussion of cities. Tom, I think we probably talked about this in previous bonus episodes. Marcus Daly is curious. He says he's never found a city he didn't like.
For something or other.
But something, well, I mean, that's quite...
So that's there's always a positive in every city. Partly because most of them have been for leisure rather than duty, but even Omsk, Lovotsk, had its charms. Is that in Belarus?
I'd say that's Russia, actually, I'm guessing.
Goodness, I've never even heard of it.
Have you ever gone to a city you didn't like, Tom?
Well, that's the question. That's Marcus's question. I generally do find things to like about cities. There was one that I ended up roundly detesting, although I loved it when I first got there.
Okay.
And that, Dominic, was the beautiful town of Yanina in central Greece.
Oh, yeah, and yeah, in the north of Greece, on an island, isn't it?
Well, there's a lake, and then there's an island on it. And in that on that island, there was a beautiful Turkish-era building where Ali Pasha...
I was just about to say Ali Pasha.
He got shot through the ceiling. So he was upstairs, and an assassin shot him, and it went up and inflicted genital damage, I think it would be fair to say.
Oh, Tom. Surprise.
So he got taken out. So I was interested to see that because of Ali Pasha had a fling with Lord Byron when Byron visited Yanina.
So this is early 19th century?
Early 19th century.
He's a sort of Albanian breakaway from
the Ottoman Empire. Yeah. He's kind of effectively independent. And he was a kind of, he was a tremendous lad. I mean, I'd see any word for him.
Right.
But also, Yanina had the beautiful and very, very atmospheric shrine to Zeus at Dodona, where there was an oak tree and people would go and listen to the rustling of the oak tree and it would reveal the future. So we went out to Dodona, listened to the rustling of the oak tree, kind of worked out what the future would be. But what the oak tree didn't say was that every day you try and get the one bus out of town to Meteora, where we wanted to go next, you're going to miss it. Because that is, in fact, what happened. And it was a kind of escalatingly comical series of accidents. You know, I'd forget my passport the bus would have left early or it would be cancelled because of a storm or, I mean... So it took us a week to get out. We planned to stay there a day. And by the end of it, we were so bored of the town. We had totally sucked the pleasures dry.
Oh, my word. Wow. So when you read these guidebooks that say, you know, a few days in Yanina, in northern Greece, just to relax and enjoy the lakeside scenery, you say no.
Well, generally, we generally find that, you know, if they say allow at least 4 days, we've done a couple of hours.
But I think I've always found that, and I always enjoy the, so the more self-consciously progressive, I think, the guidebook, the worse the recommendations.
The Rough Guide is very progressive.
Well, so the Lonely Planet, I think, is utterly unreliable, because what Lonely Planet will do is it'll take a nice sort of touristy place that basically people want to go to, and it'll say, Twee, full of crowds, souvenir tat. And then it'll say, you know, if you want to find the beating heart of Britain, Middlesbrough is the place, or yes, something like that.
Yeah, no, but I think I don't think it's progressive, is it? I think I remember the Rough Guides were very, very progressive. They were very, we had it going around Spain in the late 80s, and it was all about protesting against nuclear bases and things like that. You know, if you want to take time off to protest against American nuclear bases, this is where you go.
I don't see you as a man who does that on holiday.
No, well, we didn't. We didn't. We blanked that bit. So, but Dominic, you've wriggled out of this question. Is there any city you haven't liked?
I wasn't a big fan of Minsk.
You didn't like Paris, did you?
I've never had a good time in Paris.
We discussed like this
with Agnès Poirier. The last time I went to Paris, it was with my wife, and it was mid 2000s, and it was actually Valentine's Day weekend. And the first night we arrived, we went to a restaurant. I'll name them and shame them, because I imagine they've gone out of business. It was called Le Christine. And we got food poisoning within about 2 hours of leaving the restaurant. We had the food poisoning for the rest of the weekend.
How romantic.
And it was awful. It was of such intensity that when on about day two, a chambermaid tried to get access to the room.
She couldn't, it was like going into Chernobyl.
I basically said, right, don't come in. I need 10 towels and basically I need all the toilet roll you have in the hotel.
Oh dear.
And also all cleaning products that you
but
have.
But to be fair to Paris, that's not.
Yeah,
it's not entirely the fault of Paris, is it?
So the only thing we did on this whole, my last trip to Paris was on the final sort of afternoon. I basically said, we've got to get out of this room. We're just living in a miasma. It's like basically people who went down with cholera in the 19th century.
Yeah.
We've got to get out. Let's try to go to the Musée d'Orsay. But we hadn't eaten for days. So on the way, I'd read, I think in like a Rough Guide or something, that if you have food poisoning, the thing to do is to go to McDonald's and eat McDonald's chips, French fries. So that's what we did.
Le Big Mac.
We had some chips from McDonald's and then walked around the Musée d'Orsay. But Catherine felt really faint, so we gave up after about 10 minutes. Dear.
Well, Dominic, this segues very neatly into a question from Octave Ox.
Right.
Who is, I believe, French. Dear Dominic, why do you hate the French so much? Our revolutions, our emperors, our national anthem. It seems like we can't do anything right in your eyes. Is it our effortless sense of style? Unrequited young love during your year in Aix-en-Provence? Are you just throwing red meat at your Daily Mail readers?
Oh,
or
never,
is Andouillette just not for you? The British may be a nation of shopkeepers, but know that in our eyes, you, Dominic, are an upmarket Gallery Lafayette shopkeeper.
Well, that's nice.
La France.
So he's saying I'm BCBG, as they say in France, which means sort of a bit sort of self-consciously upmarket. I have nothing against the French. As I said on the Discord, I think the French are a worthy adversary. You know, we're obviously incredibly similar as countries. I mean, that's the sort of irony that underpins this rivalry, that we're the most, there's no country that is probably more like us in terms of geopolitical position, sense of self, all that sort of stuff, as France. But the antagonism is kind of it's like a local derby, isn't it? That's the fun of it. It's like, why do, you know, Liverpool and Everton or Man City and Man United? I mean, it's the closeness that informs
So what you're saying to Octave Ox is that the French should be flattered by your hostility.
They should see it as respect.
Yes.
As respect. I feel the same for the French as Ed Miliband famously did when he was asked what he thought of when he saw a white van. And he said, I feel respect. do you remember that?
I do. Yes, I do.
Because his shadow...
That was after Emily Thornberry had put up a sneery tweet.
She had about a white van parked in front of a house with a St. George's flag, and she had sneered at it on Twitter.
Yes.
And Ed Miliband was desperate to prove to people this will mean nothing at all to our overseas listeners. He was the leader of the Labour Party, and he was desperate to prove that he wasn't a metropolitan snob sneering at the working sort of
No, but I think
man.
That's exactly the kind of thing the French would get, because they French politicians have exactly the same problem, don't they? that they're all basically Enarch.
Yeah, been they're to the all, same school.
They've all been to the same university. And they have to kind of rush around pretending to enjoy Andouillette. And
they do. They do. But they have a very strange thing in France. I even though I've lived in France and used to speak French, I have never really understood French politics, because they have this weird thing where these Enarch, they basically go and be mayor of Bordeaux or, you know, run some region or something, but apparently without ever setting foot there or doing anything other than awarding themselves enormous contracts.
Well, it's like medieval bishoprics.
I suppose it is. Yes, exactly.
I remember the kind of history that I read when I was about 10. It was just a succession of the English beating the French.
Yeah. I was dumbfounded when I didn't realize they'd ever won a battle until about 20.
But it wasn't that. It was listening to an item on the radio that said how much richer the French were than the English. And that overturned every sense I had of the natural order of things. And it gave me a kind of psychic shock that I don't think I've ever really recovered from.
Richer now or then?
So it must have been, I don't know, 1982 or something.
Oh, I see. They were richer then, I suppose. Probably, yeah.
And so essentially, when I vote in a general election, the one kind of framework I have is, will this, which party is likeliest to enable us to do better than France?
All right. Who's going to keep up the defences of Dover or something? Is that what you worry about?
Just, you know, those kind of international league tables.
There's league tables.
That they love. We have to do better than
But we're all sort of locked together in those league tables.
I know.
I mean, we're all like 6 and 7 or 4 and 5 or something in all of those league tables, all basically inseparable. And there's some things the French will be always better at. And then the one thing I will say is, I know this is something of an idée fixe with me, as our cousins would say. Jacques Chirac was quite wrong.
About food. Yeah.
Because I do actually genuinely think, and this will scandalize some listeners, that the certainly the food in London is much better than the food in Paris. Would you agree with that, Tom?
Well, I think a great meal in Paris is still better than anything I've ever had in London.
Really? Meal? Mm.
London is more varied. I think you're
is saying that, more varied. London is much more varied.
And I speak here absolutely as a tourist. French restaurants, they kind of do the same stuff by and large.
They do.
But when they do it well, goodness, they do it well.
They do.
Anyway, listen, Dominic, we're turning this into a kind of travel podcast.
This is fascinating podcasting. This is precisely what the members are looking for. Okay, so let's move on, not move very far. Let's move 100 miles or so to the east. So there has been a dispute on the Discord about Belgium and the Netherlands. Of course, two countries that in the 1820s or so were one. If it hadn't been for the Belgian Revolution.
But Dominic, Sam's summary of this is that you started off a little Belgium against the Netherlands dispute. I can't remember. How did you start it off? What did you do?
I don't remember. Sam is a plastic. Sam, so Sam who works, is a plastic Dutchman, Tom. You know, he's... He pretends to be Dutch. I know for a fact that he wears Dutch football shirts.
He was educated at one of the oldest
schools in England, and is not in any way. Well, he's half Dutch, but he doesn't.
Dominic is now looking at me on the Zencaster that we're using. And what do you see?
Well, you're frozen. But apart from that, you're wearing an orange hoodie
with Holland on it.
Is it Holland on it?
Yeah. Yeah, so we got it in Schiphol.
Right. Oh, you've been as far as the airport.
Yeah.
So, yes, the Belgians, I think, the Belgians are the whipping boys of French jokes. So the jokes that we would used to tell when we were children, which are now, I believe, seen as not politically correct, which are the Irishman and Englishman and the Scotsman jokes, in which the Irishman was always the butt of the joke. The French had exactly the same jokes about the Belgians.
So you need three for that joke.
I think they have a Frenchman, a German, and a Belgian or something.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, I don't know. They think the Belgians are hilarious. They think their accents are really funny, and they tell all sorts of stories about how stupid the Belgians are. But I think Belgium is a splendid country. I like the food in Belgium. I've never been poisoned there. I mean, as Bart Van Loo would be the first to say from our Burgundian podcast, the cities in Belgium.
So you think of Belgium as a conglomeration of city-states.
Yeah, medieval city-states, exactly. They are splendid. Antwerp, Bruges, Ghent.
Yeah, wonderful. I mean, but then the Netherlands is great as well.
No, so you're team Netherlands rather than Belgium.
Well, I love... I, I, as I say, I love Belgium as an agglomeration of city states, but I feel less passionate about Belgium as a country than I do about the Netherlands. Which,
well, Belgium
almost everything about the Netherlands I admire, and every time I go there and I look at how their cities function and how they've organized things, I think could we not just kind of repeat 1688 and bring a whole load of Dutchmen over to sort us out? They're just very, very civilized. I think they have mastered the art of urban living.
Yeah, I suppose with the bicycles and stuff, you mean, and all that business.
All that kind of stuff. But their towns are...
But that's true, the towns of Belgium, they're nice. Bruges,
yeah,
lovely.
I've just said, I'm a great fan of Belgian cities.
The thing that's interesting about Belgium is that Belgium, of course, is an invented country. So
are not all countries?
Well, yes, of course,
countries,
this is the standard thing that people say, oh, all countries are invented. I mean, that's the sort of... But obviously some countries...
Imagine communities. No, I agree. Yeah.
Some countries obviously have very... I mean, France is a great example, actually. I mean, France, you know, the hexagon has pretty much existed in the same place. Okay, admittedly, people spoke different languages within it and stuff, but it's for at least, you know, well over 1,000 years. Belgium has only existed since the 1830s and has two linguistically different communities who absolutely despise each other. I mean, even on the Discord, the Flemings were laying into the Walloons and saying what an utter waste of space they were, and they'd happily be rid of them, and they'd be so much richer.
I mean, do you not think the lesson of Bart Van Loo's podcast episode,
yeah,
was that thinking of Belgium as the Duchy of Burgundy makes it more glamorous.
It does.
The dwarves and the feasts and the wine coming out of kind of statues of lions and things.
Of course it does. I mean, because that's what the word Burgundy, you know, conjures up. Whereas the word Belgium, I think, to most English people, and I apologize to Belgian listeners and to Bart, but the word Belgium, or indeed Belgian, to people in England connotes boring blandness.
And the First World War.
Well, it's that First World War, or I mean, I know some listeners will bridle at this, but it conjures up committee meetings held under the auspices of the European Union. It's a bit like the thing, have we talked about this in the podcast before, about Euro Disney? How Euro Disney had to be renamed, because when the Disney came up with the idea for a Disneyland in France, they thought that one of the biggest markets for that would be in Britain, because so many British people went to Florida. You know, massive fans of this. But they found, only after they'd opened it, because to Americans, the word Euro connoted sophistication and kind of people sipping wine and, you know, eating mussels and just generally having a very glamorous life. What they didn't realize was that in England, which was their big, hopefully they were hoping their biggest market, the word Euro connoted boring middle-aged men arguing about the dimensions of sausages.
Yes.
When
did Euro Disney open? Was it in the 90s?
Yeah, about 92.
So it was all the kind of Maastricht.
It was exactly exactly at that point.
Yeah. Okay,
and then when they renamed it Disneyland Paris, people are like, oh, well, if it's Disneyland Paris, that's fine. That's a different matter. It's not been designed by some Belgian committee, which is the sort of the British reaction.
I mean, don't you think that, I guess the difference in resonance is that because Belgium is relatively recent,
yeah,
it hasn't had time to accrue the kind of romantic associations.
Agreed.
That the Netherlands has, the Dutch Republic, which has had a golden age.
But Tom, I don't think most people in Britain think of the Netherlands as a romantic country.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about most people in Britain. I'm talking about me.
Okay, fair enough. Now, Dom, the producer, says, discussion of Belgium. He says, be careful. This is what the Russians say about Ukraine, not a real country. I'm not saying Belgium is not a real country. It is a real country. But I think European countries tend to celebrate their roots in antiquity, don't they, Tom? Spain, you know. I mean, if you think of a very, very recent European country, so North Macedonia, where I've been, they obviously have all the stuff about Alexander the Great, and they kind of have all this stuff about Macedonian ethnicity, which outsiders often say is largely invented. But the Belgians, so then their name comes from a tribe, doesn't it?
The Belgae.
But their roots really, I mean, if they called themselves Burgundy, it would be a different matter. Because then they would be able to lay claim.
I think that's a missed opportunity.
It is. It's absolute folly. So now that we've sorted the Belgians out, we should move on. Oh my gosh! Look at this. This is a big question. So Hibs, not Hibbs. Well, let's start with Hibbs. Hibbs is writing a religious education and philosophy curriculum for a primary school, and each topic is formed around an inquiry question. And he has been asked, one of these questions is, what is the most important thing to have ever happened?
Okay, and it's meant to be answered by 10 to 11-year-olds. And Simon Girdleston...
He's waded straight in.
He really has. So he has listed human use of fire, agriculture, metallurgy, writing, controversial one here, invention of the joint, stock company, and antibiotics.
Well, which of these would you choose, Tom?
Well, I wouldn't choose any of them, because obviously the most important thing that's ever happened ever is it must be the Big Bang.
Okay. Well, the most important human thing?
The emergence of life.
Okay, well, the
emergence of life.
Yeah, fine.
Have you come across Matthew Cobb, professor of zoology at Manchester University?
No.
He wrote a brilliant book about how wholly unexpected life is. It's just incredibly odd. And it was in the context of the search for alien life. And there are all these people kind of looking at moons around Jupiter and stuff, looking for traces of alien life. And he made the very sensible point that there's no point in looking for Earth-like planets to see if life has emerged on them.
Yeah.
When we have the most Earth-like planet is, of course, Earth.
Right.
And life has only emerged once on Earth. Whereas if it was easy, it would be emerging all over the time, spontaneously. It'd be kind of, you know,
okay,
underwater in vents or whatever, which implies that it's a very, very weird and strange thing.
Producer that life has emerged. For 10 and 11-year-olds, Tom.
Yeah, but they'd love all that. The strangeness of the emergence of life.
Okay.
Makes you think, isn't it? It's the kind of thing you love to think about when you're 10.
All right. Of Simon Girdleston's suggestions, which do you think is the most important?
Fire.
More important than agriculture?
Yes.
Okay.
Because everything follows from fire.
Okay. Fair enough. Fair enough.
Because if you can cook meat, then your brain grows. So I gather that it was the discovery of fire that enabled Homo sapiens to evolve.
You get a bigger brain if you eat meat.
Apparently.
That's good news.
Mm-hmm.
That's good news. I like...
Over the course of the millennia.
Okay. Not over the course of a lifetime.
No. So if you...
Atkins diet or whatever it is, where people eat steak all the time, doesn't make you cleverer.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not a scientist.
Well, the great thing about this podcast is we did travel, we do nutrition.
speaking with position of absolute ignorance on all these various...
So we've done the...
What would you say? What would you say?
I think it's fire and agriculture, isn't it? I mean, I was thinking agriculture is pretty important because agriculture gives you states, doesn't it? Community, sort of.
And as we discussed with Carl Harper, terrible disease.
Yeah.
Because you're suddenly living amongst shit.
Yeah.
And I love the thing he said, that we're the only species ever that has actively chosen to live amidst shit.
You love that fact. I don't know what you love about that.
Well, it kind of makes you think, doesn't it?
Yeah, I suppose so. All right. So,
here's a good one.
Go on.
In reference to, is it Acemoglu?
Yeah, I think it is.
Acemoglu and Robinson's Why Nations Fail. People are questioning why single theory history books still come out and still do so well.
So I gave Aurelius, that book a pasting in the Sunday Times years ago. I did, yeah.
Aurelius says, there's always been a temptation to have a why to history, not a why of causes, but a why of principles. An example is the idea that all empires eventually get powerful enough that they succumb to decadence and a more martial, barbarian people then overwhelm them. That's very true. That is the thesis, the guiding thesis of the first work of history ever written.
Yes.
Herodotus.
Ibn Khaldun.
Ibn Khaldun. Ibn Khaldun. It's also his thesis
as well?
Yeah.
So you think arguing that single theory explanations of history are embedded in the discipline from the very beginning?
I do.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought of that. I think I hate those books. I always give them very disobliging reviews. I take a very low view of books that claim to have found, you know, the formula, the explanation.
There are six
ingredients for an empire to rise or something like that. Because I always think when you dig into them, they always turn out to be quite simplistic or they're just truisms.
But Marx is basically, that's the kind of historian he is, right?
Yeah, well, he's a very high class version of that.
He's very high class.
Yeah. I'm not disputing that he's a high class version, but he is still a high class version of it. I mean, it's interesting. So compare him with Gibbon, who wrote similarly colossal books. So Gibbon also has theories about why the Roman Empire fell. But I think what is distinctive about him is that once he's got into his narrative, he pretty much forgets about the theories and just tells great stories. And
until he gets to the end, and then he suddenly...
And then he remembers.
Recap.
It's the classic... He's basically the classic thing of a student who's written an essay, yeah, where right at the end of the essay, he thinks, Christ, I haven't answered the question.
So, yeah.
So then he has to put in an extra chapter, reasons for the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. But I think when you do any period in history in depth, as the complexities mount up and the contingencies... Then, of course, although you see reasons why things rise and fall or whatever, the idea of reducing it, and there's this kind of these kinds of books that basically they're working towards the construction of a table or a graph, a single diagram that would explain how all history works. And I think they particularly appeal to what I would call, well, to sort of readers who are
who don't really like history,
yeah, but who do like business books. So readers who think, I would like to read a 300-page book on secrets of leadership from the great emperors, you know, and what they want to hear are like five rules that will be something about inclusivity with the workforce, away days.
Invade Belgium.
Yeah, yeah, basically. They want a series of, they want a neat formula. And I think people find that it's a combination of that and a slightly conspiracy theory-ish thing. So people who like conspiracy theories like thinking, I'm in the know. I know why this happened because of the Freemasons or whatever.
I mean, I suppose I feel I slightly tempted to stick up for it simply because Dominion, perhaps just to a slight degree, has a quality of this is the explanation for things.
Everything. For everything.
Not for everything. But
you don't have a graph, Tom.
I don't have a graph. No, I don't have a graph.
And also, you're not claiming that you're claiming that there's an ingredient, a very important ingredient,
yeah,
that has been
included.
Exactly, that has been included. And you're sort of saying, if we trace this thread through, you know, then it illuminates lots of things and we'll see things in a different light. But you're not claiming...
No, it's not an abstraction that can be imposed on...
Exactly.
So, be it the will of God or class conflict or...
Precisely.
Whatever.
I mean, this is why... I mean, because I obviously write a lot of modern political history, and people sometimes ask, what do you think about political science, or have you read such and such a political science book? And I often find them incredibly unsatisfying, because there'll be good stuff in them, and then they'd say, well, here are the diagrams now, and here's the theory. And I think, why did you even need the theory? You don't need to work towards an all-encompassing theory or a model of how something... I mean, I don't care about the model, just tell me what happened.
What about so of some recent ones that have been quite influential? Paul Kennedy's "The Rise and Fall of the Great Powers."
Yeah, I quite like that.
The idea that empires inherent, you know, there's inherent overstretch.
Yeah, but again, I think that's a truism, though, isn't it? I think what's interesting is that he's good enough a historian. He lets his examples kind of breathe. He's not completely trying to subordinate them to the thesis. But also the thesis is not so, I mean, you know, is there an element of, do you have to have a kind of Sherlock Holmes level of perspicacity to be able to deduce that empires overextend themselves and then fall? I don't know. What do you think? I think it's a good book.
Yeah, I think it was a good book. And very much in that tradition of Herodotus, Ibn Khaldun, mm-hmm. that you know, there are elements within great powers that inherently lead to problems.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. And what about Samuel Huntington, Clash of Civilizations?
See, a lot of people would say that's too simplistic.
Yeah.
And I think probably, I wonder whether it is too simplistic. So, you know, there are places that don't quite fit in his model. Greece, if there's a Clash of Civilizations, doesn't he argue that the Orthodox world plays a part in this?
Yeah, he does, yeah.
So what would you do with Greece? I mean, which side is Greece in? Greece is part of the EU.
In defence of that, in defence of Huntington, though, the idea that cultural matters or religious matters or whatever that might seem ridiculous to a kind of a secular, educated Westerner do have purchase. And he wrote that again, I think, in the 90s, was it?
Yeah, it did. Yeah,
so before 9/11,
you
know, all that kind of stuff. But clearly looking at, you know, at India now or Russia or Muslim world, I think that those civilizational dimensions have had a greater saliency than they might have. It might have seemed obvious in the 90s, say.
I agree with you, Tom. I think that's so, right. I think he's absolutely right that, let's say, religion, culture, that they really make a massive difference. I mean, you know, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which I'm sure we'll get onto in just a second. Vladimir Putin's almost kind of religiously inflected sense of Russian exceptionalism and Ukraine's place in that story. I mean, if you don't understand all that, you don't understand why he's done what people. Ideological motivations matter, in other words.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I don't think that means that they are, that you can just draw up a little table and say, well, this determines how everyone's going to behave forever, kind of thing. So we had lots of questions about the Russian episodes. James Hellier, does the situation have its roots in the collapse of the Soviet Union? I think it absolutely does. I think we talked about this a little bit. We've done a podcast with Helen Thompson, haven't we, about oil?
Yes, which will be coming out. So if you're listening to this on Wednesday, it'll be coming out tomorrow.
Yeah. And I think we do touch on this a little bit about the way in which, so the way the Soviet Union has collapsed so quickly with almost nobody expecting it. And as James says, Boris Yeltsin and other people had basically expected Russia and Ukraine to stay in some sort of union and were astonished and taken aback when it didn't. And certainly a lot of people around Yeltsin, you know, they thought that, as we said in the podcast, that there was going to be some kind of negotiation about Ukraine.
Well, also, James Hellier's point, which he also says that the rush to independence seems initially to have been a way for the local communist leadership to stay in power.
Yeah, that's exactly
right. So kind of, you know, the power of contingency and...
Yeah, exactly right. Red Wang says, it's looking back at the Georgian War and Crimea, it's baffling that no one saw the current Ukraine invasion as a possibility. I'm reminded of the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, which should have been,
that's a brilliant analogy.
It is a nice analogy, actually, and he's right. And I think, I suppose it's even more glaring with the Ukraine invasion because we didn't see it happening because we didn't want to see it. Isn't that the reality? Mm. People kept thinking.
I think also it was because the Middle East was in absolute chaos. It was, you know, Islamic State and the Syrian civil war and everything. And it all just seemed part of a kind of continuum of awful stuff happening.
Yeah. But also the Middle East was getting much more attention. I think people had kind of been deadened.
Yes. So people's focus was very much on that.
Yeah.
And Russia, I think, was already getting involved in Syria. And so it felt, looking back at it, as though it was part of a kind of Middle Eastern story rather than being something deserving of attention on its own.
Well, Russia, basis. Russia's bad behavior. Yeah, I think as well, people just had completely invested so much almost intellectual capital in the idea that the Putin was you could do business with him. I mean, that's definitely what a whole generation of Western politicians, Angela Merkel being the most obvious example, had done. I mean, Gerhard Schroeder obviously had invested, basically.
Yeah.
Putin will give me lots of money. But in Germany in particular, the idea that, you know, you just have to do, he's a rational actor. And actually, we can completely moderate him and all that. That was very deeply embedded.
Do you think also with Putin that it was a slight kind of element of you slow boil a frog? Because he began, you know, we had that extract at the beginning of the podcast of George Bush looking into his soul and saying that he was an honourable person.
Yeah.
That Putin was a fixture at kind of G8 meetings.
Yeah, and, he was.
You know, all that kind of that early stuff. And so it was hard to think of him as Hitler.
I agree with that. Do you know what? I was having a chat this morning with Andrew Preston, who's appeared on this podcast about Vietnam. Show, and we were chatting about this very issue because we were reminiscing about how we went for a drink just after the invasion of Crimea. And we had a kind of big conversation about, I thought the West should have responded much more robustly, and Andrew didn't. Andrew thought I was being kind of alarmist and stuff. And we talked at the time about...
So did you have the satisfaction of Andrew saying that you'd been right?
I did. I did, actually.
Is that why you're telling this
anecdote? I didn't want to embarrass him, but I did.
He'll be thrilled to know that.
But we were sort of chatting about... Well, I think part of the funny thing, actually, with the sort of... You said about Putin being Hitler is, of course, that because we know that history doesn't really repeat itself identically...
It rhymes.
As people very boringly say... Because we know, because that's such a cliche and therefore we want to kick against it, if you sort of said, well, now he's come for Crimea, he'll come for the rest next, you know, there's sort of a whole rolling your eyes. I suppose you think he's Hitler, do you?
So there's this comment from Al Akfar. I was surprised at how little reaction the invasion of Crimea generated. The whole thing reeks of Sudetenland and it's hard to escape the solution that if Russia had faced serious sanctions then, it wouldn't now be invading.
Yeah. Well, actually, funny enough, this conversation I had with Andrew Preston this morning, Sue Datenland came up with Chrome in regards to Chromie, because he said it's such a cliche that you don't want to say it, but it is such a great analogy, because he pointed out, and he said, you know, what makes it such a perfect analogy is that Crimea had been Russian, you know, back in the 19th century or something, and that probably most of the people in Crimea did feel more Russian than Ukrainian, rather like the Sudetenland. The truth of the matter was most of the people in the Sudetenland were Sudeten Germans and did want to be united with Nazi Germany, which is one reason why it was easy for the West to appease Hitler.
Yeah.
As they did Putin in 2014. So it is a good analogy. I'll tell you what, we had a really good question here. I like it because it's about me. Amy Mantravadi. Putin might be the greatest modern evidence against Dominic's deterministic view of history, because he's a single person who undoubtedly has affected history in unique ways, probably more so than most or all American presidents.
How do you plead to that?
I think that's actually a very fair point. I think Gorbachev as well, going back to our Russia, you know, his decisions did make a massive... Or Yeltsin.
But you see, you can frame it very differently, because people are saying, is there not something deeply rooted in the matrix of Russian history that makes this kind of behavior inevitable? That's what they're also saying.
Yeah, it is. That's right. And also, any Russian leader at some point would have wanted to get Ukraine back.
I mean, you know, and this is, of course, you know, Russia is the country of Tolstoy. War and Peace, the great argument of War and Peace is that Napoleon is merely, you know, surface froth on the great heaving ocean.
Exactly. I mean, this is one of the arguments, isn't it? That one of the really interesting kind of arguments in all the opinion pieces right now, some that say that Putin is, that nobody else would have decided as he's decided, and that this is his, you know, his own personal project, and others who say there's something very structural about this. That
so we know what people are going to be writing in exams in 50 years' time.
But that is exactly what they'll be writing in exams, won't they?
Well, and on that theme of Putin, a comment from Sophie Pottle.
Yep.
The one unanswered question I felt I had was why and how Putin? It seemed like he went from a semi-anonymous agent in Germany to head of FSB and leader of Russia with no clear explanation. His brutality in Chechnya is surely only an explanation for his staying in power.
That's a really good question. I noticed, Tom, you've switched pronunciations.
I have.
You've really gone all in with the...
I got schooled.
So on Putin, as you call him...
as he does himself.
Yeah. Well, who cares what he thinks? I mean, God almighty, he's... I mean, I'm not Vladimir Putin's lapdog, Tom, unlike some people on this podcast. So Sophie's question is absolutely a really good question. And I think nobody has solved that mystery. There's clearly a moment in the late 1990s where he is identified by the sort of securocratic elite around Yeltsin. There must be a moment when they pick on him and when he does a deal with Yeltsin's family and with some of the oligarchs. But no one knows the details of that or why him and not somebody else. Because as she says, he had no public persona at all. I mean, no one had heard of him before 1999 or something. And then suddenly he's president of Russia. So, that's a really fast... I mean, we won't know, I guess, until he's dead. Maybe not even then, how it happened. It's a really, really interesting story.
Right, so, Dominic, should we just very quickly whistle through?
Yeah.
Last Emperor of Mexico, Matthew 3, at the conclusion of the episode, I couldn't help but think of the Mexican army in Texas earlier, 1836, and of course the Alamo. Yeah. I mean, that's a whole different story, isn't it? That we should definitely look at.
I don't know much about that, actually, to be completely honest.
Well, that's never worried us in the past.
That's not a problem in this podcast.
St. Patrick. Bronwyn Brown, I've already started enraging my American Irish colleagues in another server with the fact that St. Patrick wasn't Irish. Thank you. I'm surprised by that. I'd thought the one thing,
that everybody knows.
Yeah, it's one of the big facts. I mean, along with the fact he got rid of snakes, which obviously isn't true.
Yeah.
That he got kidnapped from Britain, which is true.
I'll be honest with you, Tom. Until about 5 years ago, I didn't know that he wasn't Irish. But then I don't really take a great deal of interest in medieval saints.
Yeah, well, that's a very sad... Nothing to be proud of.
So there's more snake action from Stavros. The mother of Constantine the Great, St. Helena, is purported to have rid Cyprus or a monastery in Cyprus. I mean, those are slightly two different things of snakes. When she visited the island in the 320s, she did it by bringing cats over from Palestine. Did you know this, Tom?
That's slightly less miraculous, isn't it?
Well, first of all, it's cat-based. But secondly, there's a big difference between ridding the island or a single monastery. I mean, getting the snakes out of one monastery seems pretty straightforward, I would say, if you've got cats.
I don't know.
And Greg Noonan. Do you want to end with Greg Noonan, Tom?
Just listen to the St. Patrick's episode, which was fantastically entertaining and informative. Yes, I do. That's a very good comment.
Yeah,
should we just leave that. It at that? Between the Dark Ages episode and this, I know you've covered a lot of the ground concerning the export of Christianity to Ireland and the re-export from Ireland, but I would be interested in an episode on Celtic Christianity generally. I'm sure it's très sacral.
Are you interested in that?
Well, I'm interested in the subject, but the question of whether there is such a thing as Celtic Christianity opens up a whole can of worms.
See, I've sat through you talking about St. Patrick and St. Cuthbert.
Yeah, well, it was St. Cuthbert's Day on last Sunday.
So you've had celebrated it. You've had two medieval saints in the course of one calendar year.
I know.
Some people would say that's too many. I mean, I absolutely wouldn't say that, of course.
Well, I celebrated St. Cuthbert's Day by re-listening to that Cuthbert's Day episode.
Your own podcast.
I did. I enjoyed it very much. I learned a lot.
That's good.
And at the end of it, you say, well, you've conclusively proved that St. Cuthbert is well worthy of a podcast.
So I'm just reminding you of that.
Yes, you did.
That was the early days of the podcast when I was...
Were you still being polite?
Yeah, I was trying to... I was encouraging you. I was building up your confidence.
Well, you've encouraged me, and that's why I want to do some...
Yeah, clearly too
much. More on that topic.
Right. So listen, we should advertise what we're doing. We have... the anniversary is approaching, very dear to some of us in Britain, dear to me because I've written a book about it, of the Falklands War. So we are going to do a whole series about the Falklands War, how it happened, what on earth it was, where are the Falklands? But also, I think it was an absolutely pivotal moment in the post-war history of Britain. Arguably, I would say the most pivotal moment. The moment when things might have changed and Britain might be a very different country.
So I'm looking forward to that. So we're recording that tomorrow.
We are. I should be making some big claims.
What else do we have? We have, we've got two guests. We've got Francis Young coming to talk about his research into the role that the occult has played over the course of British politics.
Yeah, very strange.
So from King Arthur and Merlin right the way up to...
Theresa May? No.
I think so. Witchcraft trials in the Second World War.
Okay.
Great fun.
He's not going to be claiming that Ted Heath was a witch or something.
Well, I don't know. We'll find out. And we've got Rana Mitter talking about the Cultural Revolution.
We do indeed.
No one better than that. And for Easter, we will be recording a special on the crucifixion.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to that. Right. So we're obviously saving the history of the Easter egg for a later year in podcast history. All right. We wish you all a very happy week, and we will reconvene this time next week, I imagine. All right.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.